Hello and welcome to The Week at Work. My name is Michelle Byrne and I'm here with my co-host, Claire O'Connor. And as always, we'll have a look at the weekend and papers and stories for the week from a left perspective. The Week at Work is a part of the Left Bloc and Political Education Media Project. And you can find more information and support us on patreon.com/leftbloc. And as always, it will be our Patreon members who find out about any upcoming Left Bloc festivals that we may have done in the past. So do be sure to sign up as a Patreon to find out more details as they come in the next few weeks. And with that, Claire, you have had an extremely busy week, as always. I know that you have been extremely close to the starter story that's been happening and ongoing for the last while. Can you give our listeners a bit of an update on what's happening this week? Some good news for a change.
Yeah, it's so nice to be starting with some good news. We've talked about it so many times on this podcast, so, you know, regular listeners will know my mom was in the Stardust. She was, you know, really badly injured. She was like second last person to leave hospital. Surgeries for years. It's been a part of our lives, my whole life. Loads of my family have been involved in the campaign for years. I got involved years ago. Just before, actually, this current mechanism, before Lynn Boylan and Darren Macken came to the families with the inquest kind of legal mechanism, it was like the last legal opportunity to have this play out in some kind of court setting. So it's been years. We had a postcard campaign. We lobbied the Attorney General. You know, it's been a real long slog in terms of getting to the inquest. It started a year ago. And on Thursday, we got a verdict. And the verdict was everything we could have possibly hoped it would be, and more, to be honest. So the verdict was unlawful killing. And it was unlawful killing for all 48 young people whose lives were taken. And it was the most extraordinary thing I've ever experienced, like, in the courtroom. It wasn't just a verdict. So the jury had to, I mean, this jury has to, like, again, it's nearly a year. They've heard pen portraits of the people that died. They've heard expert testimony and witness. They've heard stories from survivors like my mom and Jimmy Fitzpatrick, who talked about what happened that night, but also how they were treated afterwards. Like I've said loads of times, my understanding of class comes from the Stardust, because from a really young age, like, I remember being 3-4 years old, and, you know, my mom's heavily scarred all over her body. So it was always something that was visible and talked about. And her and my nana would always talk about how it was because of where they came from that they were treated the way they were. And even, you know, Charlie Bird said, if this was Donnybrook instead of Bonnybrook, it never would have happened. So on Thursday for the verdict, the jury had to answer a number of questions. And they started off with, do you know where the fire started? Yes, they said it started in the hot press. And all of us sitting there, it was literally like, every time they answered a question, we realised we were kind of like a step closer to getting that verdict. And, you know, it was, do you know where it started? Do you know what time it started? Did the carpet wall tiles, you know, cause the fire to spread more? Yes, yes, yes. It was all these yeses to the questions and we knew we wanted those yes answers. And then the final one was, and the coroner said to the jury beforehand, have all 48 people got the same verdict? And when they said yeah to that, we, you know, the anticipation was growing. We knew it was going to, we had a feeling it was going to be good. And when they said unlawful killing, almost everybody on our side of the room, like where the families were, and the families were everywhere, it was standing room only, solicitors didn't have seats, the doors were open, it was just incredible, jumped up in the air, like jumped up screaming, punching the air, hugging each other, just people hysterically crying. But also, like, the censor, obviously it was bittersweet, and I've had so many people contacting me saying, like, I don't want to say, you know, congratulations, or it's a good thing. I'm like, it absolutely is a good thing. There was a sense of such relief and happiness and almost joy in the room, because it's 43 years of battling. This happened before I was born. There's people in that room who this has been every single day of their lives, pushing and fighting for justice and having so many doors shut in their face, having the government complicit in reports that made absolutely no sense other than to lead to the owner of the club getting compensation. I mean, like, 27 years on the record, it said that was probable arson. They blamed the people. Like, I know when the yes to the hot press where the fire was came out, my ma burst into tears, because for her, that was saying that you didn't do anything wrong here. This was not your fault. We're not blaming you anymore. We know that you didn't start this. Like, the layers upon layers of that, like, were just, it was just incredible. And then the jury got, like, I'd say about 5 minutes standing ovation, clapping when she thanked them. Everybody stood up and clapped them. Like, it was just the emotion. I felt the day after like I'd been out for 3 days, you know, just, it was like this emotional hangover. We all went down to the Garden of Remembrance, and there was like a press conference, and again, all these mothers who were still alive, the parents that were still alive, and family members talking about what it meant to them. And we went back upstairs to, we had a room booked in a pub, and the legal team came back, and families and survivors and people who've been involved. And we were watching all the coverage of it. The coverage was incredible, like half an hour on Virgin Media, about 40 minutes on RT News. And then every half, you could sense how, the breadth of feeling around the country. So, yeah, I just think, listen, we could do a whole hour on it, but it's incredible. And then yesterday, a lot of the families were in meeting Simon Harris and Mary Lou McDonald yesterday morning. We think there's going to be a state apology on Tuesday. Now, what matters now is the content of that state apology. It can't be, "We're sorry this happened to you." It has to acknowledge the state's complicity in this, and they're, again, because there's the fire and there's tragedy, and then there's how that was compounded for 43 years. There's people whose whole lives have been this, and now it's just like, okay, you're going to acknowledge that. So, yeah, I mean, it's incredible. It's so rare, particularly as activists and, people involved in all different kinds of campaigning, and that you see actual justice. And I mean, none of it's going to bring anybody's family member back. It's not going to take away the last 43 years, but it does mean that people don't have to keep fighting. Now, people have some kind of closure, and the truth is out there, and everybody is able to, in some way, move on with their lives. And that, like, the value in that is just incredible. So, yeah, it was the most incredible day. It still is. Like, yesterday at the Palestinian demo, I got some of them to come around, and we had them in front of the stage, and there was a message out for the stage, and it was gorgeous. Like, it was just, you can just feel the sense of warmth from right around the country. And we've always known that, because like the campaign traveled around the country, and I used to bring postcards everywhere, meet the kids, to the park with the kids, and people would, everybody had a story. Like, everybody has some kind of connection to the Stardust. So yeah, it was absolutely gorgeous. Yeah, and it is nice to have a good news story for a change.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't imagine what everyone's feeling at the moment, but I can even hear and see the emotion from you today. But it's great to have a good news story. It definitely should not have taken as long as it did, but you got there in the end with some access to justice on that. And I think maybe a story that linked to that as well is around, access to justice this week is actually around the Bloody Sunday inquiry. News is coming out this week that no soldiers are to face any perjury charges over the Bloody Sunday inquiry evidence, which is obviously very disappointing. The Bloody Sunday members of families and people who are wounded released a statement saying that they're extremely disappointed at the decision not to prosecute any of the people who gave false evidence. So the soldiers gave evidence to the Bloody Sunday inquiry. They gave false evidence there, and there's been a decision made not to pursue that. And obviously that's very, very disappointing and upsetting for those families that are involved, that the Public Prosecution Service is not going forward with that. So I can see there's probably draw a line between the two stories that are after
Yeah.
happening this week.
And the thing is, I was so gutted when I saw that, because I mean, the comparison between the two, there's been a couple of, similarly to Hillsborough. Hillsborough has always been very similar to the Stardust because of the victims being blamed. Bloody Sunday was the same. That's exactly what, and it's what the state does. When the state is complicit in something like this, they try and turn it on the victims and make out that they were somehow responsible for their own abuse or pain or murder. And the Bloody Sunday families have been such a support to the Stardust families, like up in the museum. Like, there's a big memorial piece to the 48 who died, and they come down to the vigils every year, and there's a real connection there. And the timing of that for me, I was devastated for them. And it feels so final in the report, and everybody, this is the last legal mechanism. And we were told that. We were told there was no roots left as well. And I don't think they'll give up. And I think that they're coming up increasing. They're really coming up against the British Empire. I hate that word, but this is what they're, it is that sense of, it's not just the families against the soldiers. It is, this is the British colonial project, basically, that is refusing to die and is fighting back against them. And I feel like, yeah, I hope they don't give up. I hope they take some kind of heart from what happened for us on Thursday, and that, another mechanism is found, because you just can't move on when you don't have truth and justice. Like, you don't have some form of closure, because the injustice of it just eats you up, and it does eat you up, and it's that is so cruel. their family members are gone. Do you know what I mean? Like, nothing is ever going to bring them back. Why continue to compound their pain, and why continue to let their lives be destroyed by this? So yeah, just sending so much love to them, sending so much solidarity, and I just really hope that they don't listen to what's been said about this being kind of the end of the road for them, and that they do find another way.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And of course, I feel like we're reporting every week as the conflict in Palestine, the genocide, the apartheid, settler colonialism that the people in Palestine are facing that's continued to wage on. Some of the stories I'm reading this week on it are obviously the increased violence that's happening in the West Bank. I think we mentioned it in the last podcast as well. We're seeing more people murdered by the Israeli occupation forces there as well. So I don't know what rationale they're trying to give for that, when apparently this is supposed to be a retaliation. In Gaza. So that's really, really worrying to see that violence spread and increase. But there's been a couple of events this week around that. Obviously, there was a big national demo yesterday, but there has been last Sunday, we saw a number, hundreds and hundreds of people go down to Shannon Airport, where they were protesting, obviously, the wet note. No weapons to go through Shannon Airport to Israel. And time and time again, the government keep denying that this is happening. But interesting enough, actually, I was reading from Dublin for Gaza now that the department's response has been to actually hide the statistics for weapons exemptions granted, which are now haven't been available since December, where they had been publishing them monthly. So this is what they're doing. They're now hiding the complicity because the more attention has been drawn to it. So that's really, really worrying. And I know that some activists were protesting outside the Green Party Ardesh as well this weekend too, to raise that message of, you know, the complicity in that. And obviously the Green Party being in government. And, you know, even, I'm pretty sure I've said it before, but even taking their hypocrisy on, like, how much climate destruction war takes, like, even if they're trying to do, you know, go in that from that angle of, like, are, you know, being green or whatever.
Ecocide,
literally, like, there's so many problems there as to why they should care about this even more. But it's just not, the dots aren't connecting, and just they're putting their government hat ahead of everything else. But that's the way that's going. But yeah, there's been those couple of things. But interesting enough, there's been a couple of other things internationally as well happening around Palestine. Colombia and America, there's been is at the university there, there's been hundreds and hundreds of students have taken over their essentially like an encampment in the middle of their campus. Like, so they also include like Jewish organizations of students and everything, and it's been engaged in this peaceful protest demanding that their university divest from occupation, apartheid and genocide in Palestine. But they have faced severely violent repression from their school and from the US police there, mass arrests that were called for by the college itself, and trashing the encampment. But it's actually just resolved the kind of the will of the students even more. There's more people coming, they're recongregating. They've even seen like addresses from trade union leader and Amazon organizer Chris Smalls, that some people might be familiar with. He went into the encampment, and interesting enough, I saw this morning that Action for Palestine and Trinity have pointed out that Trinity is a partner of the Columbia University, so they have sent their solidarity there. And I know that the Action for Palestine for Trinity have been out calling out Trinity's complicity in genocide as well. But interesting to see those links. But again, looking at another place in Berlin, I've been reading that they are now, after bringing in a policy of banning people from speaking languages other than English and German at public events. So this is kind of like a racist attempt to crack down on Arabic, I believe.
Yeah.
But I've seen some kind of Irish diaspora there saying like, we're going to speak Irish, we better ruffle up on the Leavenster Irish so that we can speak Irish at these events as well, just to kind of
and that to
obviously send that message of anti-colonial resistance in that way as well, or true language. But I think it's very, very powerful.
That obviously comes on the back of last week, like a violent shutdown of a Palestinian conference. We saw people who were prevented from getting into the country. We saw speakers, you know, Yanis Varoufakis has been banned from Germany because of a political speech, which was not, you know, there's a hell of a lot more radical things being said. Like, just, it's one of those things where it's like Germany literally repeating the mistakes of its past and being not only just complicit in genocide, but internally, like the idea that Germany is a democracy, and these are like, this is fascist. This is literally like a road to fascism, like what they're engaging in now. And yeah, I think as well, like the Trinity stuff, I suppose, talking about, like basically like police brutality and the police oppression of protesters closer to home. We also have a couple of Irish activists here. One of them is Anna Canavan, one of them is Lena Sale, who were arrested and are up in court now for Palestinian solidarity activism, and their cases were moved into the from the district court to the circuit court, and then they were back in court during the week. So there's a kind of campaign gathering around them as well, around on a broader scale, criminalizing, activism and criminalizing solidarity. But yeah, when you see what's happening over in America and other places in the world, like the level of resistance is really increasing, and it's incredible. It's really worrying that it, and it is, it's a capitalist system then just trying to shut that down and shut down any kind of resistance. So we're kind of, it's the Palestinian solidarity, but it's also this much broader battle about like what are we potentially losing here as this goes on as well, in terms of freedoms, civil liberties.
And tying it back into the kind of like trade union worker struggle, like in California, we saw 28 Google workers being sacked for protesting Google's roles in apartheid, and there was 9 people arrested, I think. But essentially, Google, their cloud computing, they have a 1.2 billion contract to provide custom tools to the Israeli military. And it's really worrying to see the role of like big tech and in kind of Israel's military and their surveillance and their targeting apparatus. It's getting increasingly violent. And like, for example, you have Lavender, which is an AI-based system that makes people like targets and generates kill lists. Then you have this disgracefully named piece of software called Who Where's Daddy? And it's essentially a tracking it's a tracking software that surveils individuals who are on these kill lists that were generated by another piece of software, and then it signals when they have entered the family home in order for them to be bombed. And then you have another one called Hatzorah, which means the gospel, and that's an AI system that makes buildings and structures targets for airstrikes. And then you have, of course, probably people more familiar with the experimental facial recognition software program that actually just collects and data, like catalogs faces of Palestinians in Gaza. So it's completely like the role of big tech cannot be underestimated, and how it's, actually killing people.
And also, like that's a very violent and obvious, like breaches of international law and human rights law around what's happening in Israel. But the software that's developed over there creeps out around the world then as well, and is used. So like when we had the facial recognition debates in the Shannon here, I remember Lynn Moran being really strong on this. She went and did a course on it to make sure she understood the language before it even came into the doll. And talking about how inherently racist and inherently biased this software is. And when you see where it's coming from and how why it's developed, like it's developed for this reason, and then other countries then piggyback on it. And they're using inherently racist, inherently biased, violent software for, and whatever the reasons they just say they're using it for, that's what it's developed for. So the violence and the racism is basically built into it. And then we're bringing that into, other countries and other societies for other reasons and other uses. And it's like, it's so problematic. And I think one of the I've seen Israeli and Zionist public figures sharing these letters around, if Israel didn't exist, like how would you operate? And it's all related to tech, all these tech companies that are rooted in Israel. And it's a way for them to really center themselves and staple themselves in the Western world and make themselves kind of important to Western capitalism. And I think it's obviously really clever, but it is a big part of why not only the West in terms of the military industrial complex, but actual, global companies are so committed and tied to Israel.
Yeah, and that's something that we need to think about when we're hosting so many of these big tech headquarters in Ireland, and the role that we're playing in this too, because, people can feel like these things are far away, but actually it's all interconnected, and we definitely have a role to call that out as well. And I guess, again, closer to home, on this issue as well, we saw the Communication Workers Union had their conference this week, and there was loads of great motions there and debates and everything. But for the sake of the pod and the what we're talking about now, one of the motions that was passed, very interesting, was that postal workers could are going to pursue not handling any letters to Israel. So this is really interesting. They have basically, on post workers have kind of sought the right to refuse to handle this on a basis of conscience. So there was a discussion actually on RTÉ Radio this morning about how they're going to go about that. You know, they're going to go to management and they're talking about linking in with their global contacts in Uni Global and seeing how they could get international assistance to facilitate that. And they're kind of still discussing like what would it look like? Is it male? You know, is it all male? Is the practical, you know, what are the practicalities? Is it personal mail? Is it mail from embassies or to embassies and all of that? So it's interesting. On Post, I know, have already come out and said it require, you know, by law you're required to handle all mail without discrimination, but obviously they haven't come to the table yet with the workers to discuss how that would work. But it's who want to play their part, and they're sending a message essentially that business shouldn't be as usual. And you know, when we're seeing our own government, you know, not apply any sanctions to Israel and not do that, then the workers are going to take it back into their own hands and they're going to apply these sanctions. And that's essentially what we've been doing. And it's the same with the boycott, the Western sanction movement, and people going in and, you know, targeting companies that, you know, that are profiting off genocide and taking those products off the shelves. I think that shows how people can take action in those ways. But yeah, and there has been a lot, I guess, going on actually for workers. There's bit of trade union season. Aside from the Communications Workers Union, I was actually at the Unite policy conference as well this week as well. And it was really interesting to see some of the motions there too. So like you had, for example, motions on climate action. You had loads of motions. But it was interesting to hear a lot of the stories of some of the wins that are coming out actually around Seagate and Derry. That's a company that's kind of faced like serious job cuts over the last couple of years, and they've just been done a big announcement of, you know, getting trade union recognition there and actually having a facilities agreement. So the facilities agreement kind of formally sets out with the employer the rights of the shop stewards and reps to do things like getting paid time off for union duties and activities, and actually getting that recognition. Because I know obviously they've had workers there have had a very tough time there the last couple of years, so it's great to see that happen. And obviously then it was, you know, recognized that the recent Supreme Court decision kind of vindicating the right of Unite mechanical members as well to be able to take that industrial action. So literally the day after the conference, they're already gearing up to get back into that industrial dispute, pick off where they were left off with all that blocking from that injunction. So they're restarting the campaign now for the reinstatement of the first hour of their travel time back. So that's really interesting. And there was like some of the figures that was at that conference is really interesting. It's like 300 live disputes across Britain and Ireland in Unite alone. And obviously then you're seeing great news coming through a number of other unions as well. So obviously I mentioned the communication workers. You know, we heard this week that both air and on post workers are getting a pay rise of 4% a year, which is kind of adding up to 11% over kind of like three whatever over those couple of years, for some members of staff, and then on post been the same. And then I also read that FSU are balloting members in PTSB for a near 5% increase as well. So it's great to see so much action happening across, and want to continue to see, you know, workers taking that action. And actually, in that vein, there was a different type of story about workers this week. A bit embarrassing, I think, for the Labour Party, the party of workers, I think. But one of their councillors was brought to the WRC for being a bad boss, it seems, underpaying when they're seamstress. Seamstresses by like, yeah, well, anyway, the person was awarded like 11 grand for multiple breaches of employment rights by their boss, who is a Labour. Was a Labour County Councillor. She's now stepped down. So that's interesting to see that happen as well, but quite shocking to see that from a Labour Party councillor, who, well, previous now ex-councillor at this point, she's had to resign. But yeah, quite a lot going on there in the space of workers' rights, and it's great to see it. And hopefully cover more of these industrial disputes and workers' wins as much as we can.
Yeah, and I think the fact that she was the actual spokesperson for business, you know, was just an extra blow to that. Raising that story as well, it really brought home how important your working conditions are in terms of you getting status to stay here and, you know, visas and things like that, because some of it was like an hour here and there. that meant the difference between this woman being able to her visa approval going ahead, it being rejected, you know, like the consequences of how an employer treats an employee when they're not a citizen, you know, it's like it's just so far reaching. And it's shocking to see that happen from somebody who's supposed to be a representative for the party of workers. On that, actually, kind of actually moving on from migrant issues, an issue that we didn't cover because we had a different type of podcast last week was you know, the murder of Joseph Strock, which was absolutely shocking. And I think what was even more shocking was it really didn't feel like it got a lot of coverage, and not nearly as much coverage as it should have had. Like, this was a man who was murdered because he wasn't speaking English. It was just a blatantly outright racist attack. And then his friend David Druzanich, who was with him and was beaten so badly, like, he did an interview with his with the father of Joseph Strock, basically. I think it was Prime Time the other night, and they talking about it, and like the details of it were just absolutely shocking. Like, this man is now, he survived what was essentially an attempt on his life, in that his friend was murdered. They've lived here for years, they've worked here for years. And hearing his father talk about it and say that he said no, kind of, you know, senior official, nobody had contacted him, nobody had given the condolences. I mean, that's just an outrageous way for the state then react to this. I feel like I'm genuinely stunned at how little attention it got. Obviously, there was attention in the media, but there was a beautiful vigil that was held for it by the Croatian community. And I remember I watched it being live streamed, and I was devastated by it because it really felt like these people were coming together on their own. It didn't feel like this, you know, national mourning or this national recognition of what had happened. And obviously, this is all happening in the context of increasingly kind of racist and anti-immigrant rhetoric, you know, a coordinated electoral far right capitalizing on these issues, on the issue, the real issues of the country, such as housing, and then trying to exploit them and twist them around into issues around immigration. We're seeing what's happening down at the IPO. We're seeing there was a, I mean, it was a very pitiful protest that was organized, but it was a protest that had come off the day before, which was a target in Roderick O'Gorman's house, you know. So very intimidating, you know, an increased level of violence around all this stuff. We saw people getting attacked down at the Crown Paints site in Coolock. There is an increased sense of violence, and there's a nervousness around this. And when we have somebody actually being murdered, and we have such a weak response from the state, and we have Helen McEntee saying that she supports the hands-off approach of the guards. There's articles there in RTE about her, you know. Like, we had an action a couple of weeks ago with Mothers Against Genocide, a stickering day. It was like, you know, it was a BDS day out in Little. The guards were waiting for the group before they got there, told them that it would be criminal damage and that they'd be arrested if they went ahead with it. Now, they went ahead with it and they pushed back on the guards, and the guards didn't arrest them. But there was a level of kind of intimidation, and there was a level of force there that hasn't been used, that wasn't used on the group of balaclavaed men who hung banners off Roderick O'Gorman's house and were outside being really intimidating. So it's the comparison between the two. And part of me gets I actually get, you don't want to give them what they want. You don't want to, like, I'm certainly not going to be calling for force from the Gardaí. Do you know what I mean? I'm never, ever going to be calling for that. But you can't but highlight the inconsistencies of how more left-wing organisers and activists are treated compared to what is violent right-wing agitators. And we, you know, but there's been a couple of articles this week who take that, and in such a vile way, try to both sides it. They'll talk about the violence of the far right and then say, you know, whether it's the left or the right, to imply that the left somehow engages in this stuff too. And it's really dangerous. And actually, these so-called middle-class centrist commentators are contributing to the very danger, you know, against the kind of politicians and the establishment that they claim to support. So there's a lot of people behaving really irresponsibly, and it's
And
leading to
even
the danger for migrants and like men at the IPO.
absolutely. And even reading that the guards are hesitant to kind of investigate Joseph Strock's murder as a hate-related offence. Like, they're trying to just kind of keep these at like as kind of individual things that are happening in different places but are not connected, when actually they are all connected, all of these hate-related incidents, and they are growing. And you know, people will say, oh well, you know, casual racism and like let things like that slide, but like, where does that lead us to? Like, it literally has led to people being murdered because, you know, they don't speak They're not speaking the language that you're speaking, and that kind of, you know, intolerance for difference is really concerning. And it is something I think that needs to be any kind of like communalizing spaces, any workplaces, anywhere, because obviously it takes quite a while for people to be that radicalized. But it is very concerning that someone could actually commit that act of violence off the back of hate, and it is something that we need to call out all the time. And obviously sending all of the condolences to Joseph Strock's family and to Damien now, who has to deal with the massive head injuries where he has actually can't remember part of the incident because he's so injured, nearly died himself, and has to suffer the grief of losing his friend through that while, you know, trying to heal himself too. But yeah, very, very scary that this can happen. And I just think that the response to this is community organizing, you know, organize with love against hate, and like, not to be cheesy or anything, but that's it. And we need to have stronger community. We need to be talking about this and more openly, because, you know, while for some people that incident might feel far away in Dublin, it can happen in any community. And I know we've said that here before, but these are incidents aren't isolated. Like, for example, you know, we do have hate mongers running in elections, both local and EU. We do have that disruption happening across, and that will become more apparent as they have platforms to speak on radio in hustings and, you know, through leafleting over the next kind of next few weeks in the lead up to the elections. And, you know, we need to make sure that that's been met and people are being politically educated as to why, you know, that's a problem, because I know immigration is going to be a big line and people need to be not hoodwinked. And that whole kind of idea of like, a lot of those candidates running as independents to deliberately hide their problematic views on immigration. So I think people really need to be careful. I'm not saying like all independents are problematic or anything like that, but I do think there's been a very targeted strategy to put more people into an independent kind of label, so that they're not attached to, you know, the National Party or whoever, that people might start to have been recognised. So that is kind of worrying, because you won't probably know what the full extent of their views are until you really dig into the depths of it. And some of that will be too late if they get elected, you know?
Yeah, and people see that as just an anti-government vote then as well.
Yeah.
And all political parties are the same. And I mean, again, it's kind of back to when you see that coordinated electoral far right, their main target is Sinn Féin. It's not Fianna Gael and Fianna Fáil.
Yeah.
So when I have conversations with people, that's the kind of stuff I raise. It's that, like, why aren't they criticising the people in power? Why aren't they criticising the people who have been in government, you know, and trying to get people to question that? Because, yeah, I do worry that independent space in polls is grown all the time as well.
Mm.
And I think that the vast majority of that is a much more right-wing conservative vote. And, yeah, coming into the local elections, I think it's going to become more toxic. There's an absolute... I don't have much faith, but there is such a responsibility on the media to not allow this stuff to be normalised anymore in hustings and in that kind of space, because this is what it leads to. It leads, like, these, you know, you also hear loads of people say, I don't mind anyone coming here if they're here to work, and I don't mind anyone coming here if they were here to, and yeah, here's two men working 15-16 hour days, and, you know, it wasn't like they were killed. He was killed because he wasn't speaking English. Like, it's you know, it's an ultra nationalism. You're talking about what's happening in Germany now. You know, this is how this forms and becomes normalized and becomes such a danger to people. But it's so scary. But I'm just so sad that it hasn't got the kind of national and state response that it deserves. This is the kind of thing that should be talked about on the floor of the Dáil.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Another story that I was looking at this week was obviously around the Ireland seeking to abandon the triple lock restriction on troop deployment. So newly appointed with no one going up against him, Taoiseach Simon Harris has just gone gung-ho with some of his positions now on what he wants to pursue in his leadership. So he's now reiterating the government's intention to abandon the triple lock, which is, you know, where Irish troops can be commissioned abroad if there's a decision by the government, a vote in the Dáil, and a UN resolution. Like, that's the triple lock, the three key pieces. So it's really worrying that they want to abandon that. Now, we have discussed this before here, you know, that it has always been the plan. They were trying to be sneaky about it at the start when they were running those kind of controversially stacked consultative forums, to make it look like people had a say in this. But rather than actually just giving a referendum on this, because I don't think anyone is really backing this. So I just think people need to be careful, because in his kind of some of his wording, he is saying, oh, but, you know, we're not abandoning neutrality. But, you know, that's completely speaking out of both sides of my mouth, you know, that's only going to end one way. And like, obviously, given the fog of war that's happening right now, like, it's just very, very concerning that we're now using that to, obviously, well, the government is using that to progress some very questionable moves around abandoning some of our measures around triple lock procedures on deploying Irish troops into what we won't know. So that's really, really concerning.
And I think as well, when you look at, there is a level of media and commentary complicity in this. That is, you know, when you look at how attacked the likes of Claire Daly is, for instance, and how what she says is misrepresented as a very strong anti-war and anti-NATO, anti-Western imperialist voice, made to seem, you know, like pranks, like, you know, really unreasonable, really, you know, untrustworthy and dangerous. Yeah, and then you bring that back to what's happening kind of in the Irish commentary, as if, like, you know, arguments around, well, we have to pay our way when it comes to safety and security, and we have to, you know, we have to contribute, and it's the only reasonable thing to do. And again, it's this normalization to make people think that if they have an alternative view, they're somehow radical and somehow dangerous. And it's, yeah, it's very problematic. We do like to end. We started on a good news story today, and it would be nice to end on a good news story too. And again, it's a story that we didn't cover because we didn't have the podcast last week, but it's the scrapping of the Disability Green Paper. And I mean, this is something that has come about completely due to the work of disability activists. And basically, you know, Heather Humphrey said that there were significant concerns with the proposal set out in the Green Paper on disability reform, which was just a horrific piece of legislation, which was going to have multiple tiers of disability. People were going to have to, you know, basically have their disability justified, and they were going to have to justify that they were entitled to a certain level of ability. Different tiers would mean that people had to work very based on the British system. And yeah, under these different tiers, kind of levels of disability payment would have been dictated, like, by the nature and the restrictions of the person's kind of perceived ability to work. So, shocking stuff. You know, it was called Dickensian. There was multiple protests outside the Dáil, and again, led by disability campaigners. And very relieved, I have to say, very relieved that it's been scrapped, but also a massive win for the activists who have pushed back against this, you know, for a long time now, since it was announced. And yeah, like, I think we have to acknowledge when we have wins like this, because it can feel, particularly at the moment with, you know, literally genocide happening, everybody can feel like they're pushing up against this kind of intolerable weight. But when we have these wins and we achieve some kind of justice, or we prevent things getting worse for people, it's really good to acknowledge it. What I will do as well, actually, I do want to kind of recognise that there's a couple of really, you know, there's a couple of great things and events happening. And obviously, get along to, you know, local organising meetings, local Palestinian meetings, local community development type pushbacks, because there's a lot of that work happening on the ground. But also, like, for instance, there's a tour that's going to be announced, Beautiful Resistance Tour, and it's basically Abdel Fattah Aboussour, who is a Palestinian artist, educator and poet, and he's doing like a speaking and workshop tour of Ireland from the 8th of May to the 18th of May, starting in Dublin. It's going to be on in Belfast. Incredible work has gone into that from Artists for Palestine and Apartheid Free Arts. You know, huge amount of groups that are supporting it, and it's going to be really beautiful. There's also, and we've mentioned on the podcast before, Trestle Fest is coming up next month, as is the James Connolly Festival. So loads of, you know, kind of left-wing organising, left-wing activities, festivals, talks. Like, there's a huge amount of work. There's actually Claire Daly and Bernadette McCallisky and Yanis Varoufakis. I think MC is Liam Cunningham. There's an event Monday week in the Button Factory. Like, there's a huge amount of events to be getting out to, and to be meeting other activists and other organisers and people who care about the same things as you do. And I know for me, that's how I end up getting involved in more and more things. It's, you know, you go to one thing, you meet like-minded people, they suck you into something else. And, you know, that's how we organise, and that's how we movement build. And yeah, so I just encourage people to look up as many of those events and as many of those kind of opportunities to engage as possible. So on that, this has been The Week at Work. My name's Claire O'Connor. I've been here with our host, Michelle Bourne. The Week at Work is a part of Left Block, which is a political education and media platform. You can find us on leftblock.ie, and that's Left Block with a C, and patreon.com/leftblock. And we will see you next week.